Chapter 7, How a Tipping Point Tips. If I told you I knew a company that invented an amazing new technology that will change the way we consume television, would that pique your interest? Perhaps you'd be interested in buying their product or investing in their company. It gets better. They have the single best product available. Their quality is through the roof, way better than anything else on the market. And their PR efforts have been so remarkable, they have even become a household name. Interested? This is the case of TiVo, a company that seemed to have everything going for them, but it turned out to be a commercial and financial failure. Since they seemed to have the recipe for success, TiVo's flop defied conventional wisdom. Their struggles, however, are easily understood if you consider that they thought what they did mattered more than why. They also ignored the law of diffusion of innovations. In 2000, Malcolm Gladwell created his own tipping point when he shared with us how tipping points happen in business and in society. In his aptly named book, The Tipping Point, Gladwell identifies groups of necessary populations he calls connectors and influencers. With little doubt, Gladwell's ideas are spot on, but it still begs the question, why should an influencer tell anyone about you? Marketers are always trying to influence the influencers, but few really know how. We can't dispute that tipping points happen and the conditions that Gladwell articulates are right. But can a tipping point happen intentionally? They can't just be an accidental phenomenon. If they exist, then we should be able to design one. And if we can design one, we should be able to design one that lasts beyond the initial tip. It's the difference between a fad and an idea that changes an industry or society forever. In his 1962 book, Diffusion of Innovations, Everett M. Rogers was the first to formally describe how innovations spread through society. 30 years later, in his book, Crossing the Chasm, Jeffrey Moore expanded on Rogers' ideas to apply the principle to high-tech product marketing. But the law of diffusion of innovations explains much more than just the spread of innovation or technology. It explains the spread of ideas. If you don't know the law, you're likely to already be familiar with some of its terminology. Our population is broken into 5 segments that fall across a bell curve. If you don't know the law, you likely are already familiar with some of its terminology. Basically, what it says is that our population is broken into 5 segments that fall across a bell curve. The innovators, early adopters, early majority, late majority, and laggards. As the law states, the first 2.5% of the population are the innovators, and the next 13.5% of the population are our early adopters. Innovators, Moore says, pursue new ideas and new products aggressively and are intrigued by any fundamental advance. Being first is a central part of their lives. As their name suggests, innovators are the small percentage of the population that challenge the rest of us to see and think of the world a little differently. Early adopters are similar to innovators in that they appreciate the advantages wrought by new ideas and technologies. They are early to recognize the value of new ideas and are quite willing to put up with imperfection because they can see the potential. Although quick to see the potential and willing to take the risks to try the new technologies or ideas, early adopters are not idea generators like the innovators. But both groups are similar, as Moore says, in that they rely heavily on their intuition. In other words, they trust their gut. Early adopters, like innovators but to a lesser degree, are willing to pay a premium or suffer some level of inconvenience to own a product or espouse an idea that feels right. Those on the left side of the diffusion curve are the ones who stood in line for 6 hours to be among the first to buy the iPhone, Apple's entry into the mobile phone market, even though they could have walked into the store a week later and bought it without waiting at all. Their willingness to suffer an inconvenience or pay a premium had less to do with how great the product was and more to do with their own sense of who they are. They wanted to be first. These are also the personality types who bought flat-screen TVs when they first came out, even though they cost upwards of $40,000 and the technology was still far from perfected. My friend Nathan fits this profile. I walked around his house once and counted no fewer than 12 Bluetooth earpieces for his mobile phone laying around his house. I asked him why he had so many. "Did they all break?" I queried. "No," he replied. "They came out with a new one." There was also about 5 laptops and various models of Blackberries and other smartphones and boxes of other gadgets laying about that never quite worked well. Nathan is an early adopter. The next 34% of the population are the early majority, followed by the late majority, and finally the laggards on the far right side of the spectrum. Laggards are the ones who buy touch-tone phones only because they don't make rotary phones anymore. The early and late majority are more practical-minded. For them, rational factors matter. The early majority is slightly more comfortable with new ideas or technologies, while the late majority is not. The farther right you go on the curve, the more you will encounter the clients and customers who may need what you have, but don't necessarily believe what you believe. As clients, they are the ones for whom, no matter how hard you work, it's never enough. Everything usually boils down to price with them. They are rarely loyal. And sometimes you may even wonder out loud why you still do business with them. They just don't get it, our gut tells us. The importance of identifying this group is so that you can avoid doing business with them. Why invest good money and energy to go after people who, at the end of the day, will do business with you anyway if you meet their practical requirements, but will never be loyal if you don't? It's not too hard to recognize where people fall on the spectrum once you're in a relationship with them. The opportunity is to figure out which is which before you decide to work with them. We all sit at different places on this spectrum depending on the product or idea. Most of us are fiercely loyal to certain products and ideas at various times and demonstrate left side of the curve behavior. And for other products or ideas, we exhibit right side of the curve behavior. When we sit on one side of the spectrum, we often have a hard time understanding those on the other side because their behavior doesn't make sense to us. My sister Sarah is an early adopter when it comes to fashion trends, whereas I'm firmly in the late majority. It was only recently that I finally caved and bought a pair of overpriced designer blue jeans. I admit they look good, but I still think they aren't worth the money, and I can't understand why my sister thinks they are. In contrast, I'm an early adopter for some technologies. I bought a Blu-ray DVD player before they had perfected the technology. I paid about 4 or 5 times more for it compared to a regular DVD player. My sister cannot understand why I waste my money on all this useless stuff, as she puts it. We will never see eye to eye in this stuff. Each of us assigns different values to different things, and our behaviors follow accordingly. This is one of the major reasons why it's nearly impossible to convince someone of the value of your products or ideas based on rational arguments and tangible benefits. It's the old Ferrari and Honda Odyssey debate again. Designer jean companies, or my sister, can talk to me until they are blue in the face about the importance of fabric quality, design, and workmanship. It goes in one ear and out the other. Similarly, it can be proven beyond a shadow of a doubt the rational benefits of choosing a $500 DVD player over a $100 one. My sister won't hear a word of it. And so the game of manipulation ensues. Again, although always effective, manipulations don't breed loyalty, and they increase the costs and the stress for all parties involved. Most people or organizations that have something to sell, be it a product, service, or idea, hope to achieve some level of mass market success or acceptance. Most hope to penetrate the bell of the curve. Getting there, however, is easier said than done. When you ask small businesses about their goals, many of them will tell you that they want to be billion-dollar businesses in X number of years. The odds of that happening, unfortunately, don't look good. Of the 27 million registered businesses in the United States, fewer than 2,000 ever reach $1 billion in annual revenues. And 99.9% of all businesses in America have fewer than 500 employees. In other words, mass market success is really hard to achieve. Big companies have similar challenges repeating their mass market success. Just because they've done it once or twice doesn't mean they know how to do it every time. The Zune, Microsoft's entry into the multi-gigabyte MP3 player market, for example, was pegged to, quote-unquote, take on the iPod. It didn't happen. Even if the quality was superior, there is more to succeeding than just the product and the marketing. Don't forget, the superior Betamax technology did not beat out the substandard VHS technology as the standard format for videotape in the 1980s. The best does not always win. Like any natural law, the law of diffusion must be considered if mass market acceptance is important to you. Refusal to do so will cost a lot of money and may result in a mediocre success, if not complete failure. There is an irony to mass market success, as it turns out. It's near impossible to achieve if all you do is point your marketing and resources to the middle of the bell, to the mass market. If you attempt to woo those who represent the middle of the curve without first appealing to the early adopters, it can be done, but at great expense. This is because the early majority, according to Rogers, will not try something until someone else has tried it first. The early majority, indeed the entire majority, need the recommendation of someone else who has already sampled the product or service. They need to know someone else has tested it. They need that trusted, personal recommendation. According to the law of diffusion, mass market success can only be achieved after you've penetrated between 15 and 18% of the market. That's because the early majority won't try something new until someone else has tried it first. This is why we have to drop our prices or offer value-added services. We're attempting to reduce the risk tolerance of those practical-minded people until they feel comfortable to buy. That's what a manipulation is. They may buy, but they won't be loyal. Don't forget, loyalty is when people are willing to suffer some inconvenience or pay a premium to do business with you. They may even turn down a better offer from someone else, something the late majority rarely does. The ability to get the system to tip is the point at which the growth of the business or the spreading of an idea starts to move at an extraordinary pace. It is also at this point that a product gains mass market acceptance, the point at which an idea becomes a movement. When that happens, the growth is not only exponential, it's automatic, and it just goes. The goal of business, then, should not be simply to sell to anyone who wants what you have, the majority, but rather to find the people who believe what you believe, the left side of the bell curve. They perceive greater value in what you do, and will happily pay a premium or suffer some sort of inconvenience to be a part of your cause. They are the ones who, on their own volition, will tell others about you. That 15 to 18% is not made up of people who are simply willing to buy the product. It is the percentage of people who share your beliefs and want to incorporate your ideas, your products, and your services into their lives as what's to their own wise. They look to what you do as a tangible element that demonstrates their own purpose, cause, or belief to the outside world. Their willingness to pay a premium or suffer inconvenience to use your product or service says more about them than it does about you and your products. Their ability to easily see why they need to incorporate your products into their lives makes this group the most loyal customers of all. They are the most loyal shareholders of all, and they are the most loyal employees of all. No matter where they sit in the spectrum, these are the people who not only love you, but talk about you. Get enough of the people on the left side of the curve on your side, and they encourage the rest to follow. I love asking businesses what their conversion on their new business efforts may be. Many answer proudly, 10%. If you ignore the principles of the golden circle, the law of averages says you can win about 10% of the business. Throw enough spaghetti against the wall and some of it sticks. To grow the business, all you need to do is more prospecting, which is why growing your business by aiming at the middle of the curve is so expensive. Though the business may grow, the average will stay about the same, and 10% is not enough for the system to tip. Likewise, 10% of your existing customers or clients will naturally show loyal to you. But why are they so loyal? Like an inability to explain why we love our spouses, the best we can muster up to explain what makes them such great clients is they just get it. And though this explanation may feel right, it is completely unactionable. How do you get more people to get it? This is what Moore refers to as the chasm, the transition between the early adopters and the early majority, and it's hard to cross, but not if you know why. If you have the discipline to focus on the early adopters, the majority will come along eventually, but it must start with why. Simply focusing on so-called influencers is not enough. The challenge is, which influencers? There are those who seem to fit the influencer profile more than others, but in reality, we are all influencers at different times for different reasons. You just don't want any influencer. You want someone who believes what you believe. Only then will they talk about you without any prompts or incentives. If they truly believe in what you believe, and if they are truly on the left side of the curve, they won't need to be incentivized. They'll do it because they want to. The entire act of incentivizing an influencer is manipulative. It renders the influencer completely inauthentic to his or her group. It won't take long for the group to find out that a recommendation wasn't made with the group's best interest in mind, but rather because of one person's self-interest. Trust erodes, and the value of the influencer is rendered useless. Refusing to consider the law of diffusion will cost you. In 1997, TiVo was racing to market with a remarkable new device. Few would debate that from the time the product was introduced to this current day, TiVo has the single highest quality product in its category. The company's PR has been extraordinary. They have achieved an unaided awareness that most brands can only dream of. They have become more than generic terms like Kleenex, Band-Aids, and Q-tips. In fact, they've been able to achieve more than generic status. They've become a verb in the English language, to TiVo. They were well-funded with venture capital and had a technology that could truly reinvent how we consume television. The problem was, they marketed their technology directly to the middle of the bell curve. Seeing the mass market appeal of the product, they ignored the principles of the law of diffusion and targeted to the masses. Compounding that bad aim, they attempted to appeal to the cynical majority by explaining what the product did instead of stating why the company or the product existed in the first place. They attempted to convince with features and benefits. They basically said to the mass market, "We've got a new product. It pauses live TV, skips commercials, rewinds live TV, memorizes your viewing habits, and records shows on your behalf without you needing to set the device." Analysts were intrigued by the prospects of TiVo, as well as its competitor, Replay, a well-funded startup backed by venture capital. One market researcher estimated that these so-called personal TV receivers would reach 760,000 subscribers by the end of the first year. TiVo finally shipped in 1999. Mike Ramsey and Jim Barton, two former colleagues who had founded TiVo, were certain the TV viewing public was ready. And they may have been, if only TiVo knew how to talk to them. But despite the excitement among the analysts and technophiles, sales were hugely disappointing. TiVo sold about 48,000 units the first year. Meanwhile, Replay, whose backers included the founders of Netscape, failed to gain a following and instead became embroiled in a dispute with television networks over the way it allowed viewers to skip ads. In 2000, the company adopted a new strategy and a few months later was sold to Sonic Blue, which later filed for bankruptcy. Analysts were stumped as to why the TiVo machines weren't selling. The company seemed to have everything going for it. After all, they had the recipe for success: a great quality product, money, and ideal market conditions. In 2002, after TiVo had been on the market for nearly 3 years, a headline in Advertising Age summed it up best. More U.S. homes have outhouses than TiVos. At the time, there were 671,000 homes with outhouses in the United States, compared to 514,000 homes with TiVo. Not only were sales poor, but the company has not fared well for its shareholders either. At the time of the initial public stock offering, in the fall of 1999, TiVo stock traded at slightly over $40 a share. A few months later, it hit its high at just over $50, and then the stock declined steadily for the rest of the year, and except for three short periods since 2001, it has never traded over $10. If you apply the principles of the Golden Circle, the answer is clear. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And TiVo attempted to convince consumers to buy by telling them only what the product did. Features and rational benefits. The practical-minded, technophobic mass market's response was predictable. "I don't understand it. I don't need it. I don't like it. You're scaring me." There were a small number of TiVo loyalists, probably about 10%, those who just got it, who didn't need an explicit articulation of why. They exist to this day, but there were not enough of them to create that tipping point that TiVo needed and predicted. What TiVo should have done is talked about what they believed. What they should have done is talked about why the product was invented in the first place, and then ventured out to share their invention with the innovators and early adopters who believed what they believed, If they had started their sales pitch with why the product existed in the first place, the product itself would have become the proof of that higher cause, proof of why. If their golden circle was in balance, the outcome may have been very different. Compare the original list of features and benefits with the revised version that starts with why. If you're the kind of person who likes to have total control over every aspect of your life, boy, do we have a product for you. It pauses live TV, skips commercials, rewinds live TV, memorizes your viewing habits, and records shows on your behalf without you even needing to set the device. In this version, all the features and rational benefits serve as tangible proof of why the product exists in the first place, and not the reasons to buy, per se. The why is the belief that drives the decision, and what it does provides us a way to rationalize the appeal of the product. Confirming their failure to tap the right segment of the market, TiVo offered a very rational explanation of what was happening. Quote, "Until people get their hands on it," Rebecca Bayer, a spokesperson for TiVo, told the New York Times in 2000, "they don't understand why they need this." If this line of logic was true, then no new technology would ever take hold, a fact that is patently untrue. Though Ms. Bayer was correct about the mass market's failure to understand the value, it was actually TiVo's failure to properly communicate and rally the left side of the bell curve to educate and encourage the adoption that was the reason so few people got their hands on it. TiVo did not start with why. They ignored the left side of the curve and completely failed to find the tipping point. And for those reasons, people didn't get their hands on it, and the mass market didn't buy it. Fast forward almost a decade, TiVo continues to be the best digital video recording product on the market. Its unaided awareness continues to be through the roof. Nearly everyone knows now what the product is and what it does, yet the company's future is by no means secure. While millions of viewers may say that they TiVo things all the time, unfortunately for TiVo, they aren't using the actual TiVo system. Rather, they TiVo using a digital video recorder probably provided by the cable or satellite company. Many try to make the argument that TiVo's failure was due to the cable company's superior distribution. But we know that people often go out of their way, pay a premium, or suffer an inconvenience to buy a product that resonates on a visceral level with them. Until recently, people who wanted to buy a custom Harley motorcycle waited upwards of 6 months to a year to take delivery of their product. By any standard, that's just bad service. Consumers could have just walked into a Kawasaki dealership and walked right out with a brand new bike. They could have even found a similar model with similar power and maybe even for less money. But they suffered the inconvenience willingly, not because they were in the market for a motorcycle, but because they were in the market for a Harley. TiVo is not the first to ignore these sound principles and won't be the last. The meager success of satellite radio technology like Sirius or XM Radio has followed a similar path. They offered a well-publicized, well-funded new technology that attempted to convince users with a promise of rational features and benefits, no commercials, and more channels than the competition. Throw in an impressive array of celebrity endorsements, including rap star Snoop Dogg and 1970s pop icon David Bowie, and the technology still didn't stick. When you start with why, those who believe what you believe are drawn to you for very personal reasons. It is those who share your values and beliefs, not the quality of your products, that will cause the system to tip. Your role in the process is to be crystal clear about what purpose, cause, or belief you exist to champion, and to show how your products and services help advance that cause. Absent a why, new ideas and technologies quickly find themselves playing the price and feature game, a sure sign of an absence of why, and slide into commodity status. It is not the technology that failed. It is how the companies tried to sell it. Satellite radio has not displaced commercial radio in any meaningful way. Even when Sirius and XM merged, hoping that the joint force of the companies could help change their luck, shares for the combined company sold for less than 50 cents apiece. And the last time I checked, XM was selling its technology by offering a discount, a promotion, free shipping, and a claim of being America's number one satellite service with over 170 channels to push their product. Give the people something to believe in. On August 28th, 1963, 250,000 people from across the country descended on the Mall in Washington, D.C. to hear Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. give his famous I Have a Dream speech. The organizers did not send out 250,000 invitations, and there was no website to check the date. How did they get 250,000 people to show up on the right day at the right time? During the early 1960s, the country was torn apart by racial tensions. There were riots in dozens of cities in 1963 alone. America was a country scarred by inequality and segregation. How the civil rights movement lifted an idea that all men are created equal to become a movement with the power to change the country is grounded in the principles of the Golden Circle and the Law of Diffusion. Dr. King was not the only person alive during that time who knew what had to change to bring about civil rights in America. He had many ideas about what needed to happen, but so did others. And not all his ideas were good. He was not a perfect man. He had his complexities. But Dr. King was absolute in his conviction. He knew change had to happen in America. This clarity of why, his sense of purpose, gave him the strength and energy to continue his fight against often seemingly insurmountable odds. There were others like him who shared his vision of America, but many of them gave up after too many defeats. Defeat is painful, and the ability to continue head on, day after day, takes something more than knowing what legislation needs to be passed. For civil rights to truly take hold in the country, its organizers had to rally everyone. They may have been able to pass legislation, but they needed more than that. They needed to change a country. Only if they could rally a nation to join the cause, not because they had to, but because they wanted to, could any significant change endure. But no one person can affect lasting change alone. It would take others who believed what King believed. The details of how to achieve civil rights or what needed to be done were debatable, and different groups tried different strategies. Violence was employed by some, appeasement by others. Regardless of how or what was being done, there was one thing everyone had in common, why they were doing it. It was not just Martin Luther King's unflappable conviction that was to stir a population, but his ability to put his why into words. Dr. King had a gift, you see. He talked about what he believed, and his words had the power to inspire. I believe, I believe, I believe. There are two types of laws, he shared, those that are just and those that are unjust. A just law, Dr. King expounded, is a man-made code that squares with the moral law. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law. Any law that uplifts the human personality is just. Any law that degrades the human personality is unjust. All segregation statutes are unjust because segregation distorts the soul and damages the personality. His belief was bigger than the civil rights movement. It was about all of mankind and how we treat each other. Of course his why developed as a result of the time and the place in which he was born and the color of his skin, but the civil rights movement served as the ideal platform for Dr. King to bring his why, his belief in equality, to life. People heard his beliefs and his words touched them deep inside. Those who believed what he believed took that cause and made it their own. And they told people what they believed, and those people told others what they believed. Some organized to get that belief out more efficiently. And in the summer of 1963, 250,000 people showed up to hear Dr. King deliver his I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. But how many people showed up for Dr. King? The answer is zero. They showed up for themselves. It was what they believed. It was what they saw as an opportunity to help America become a better version of itself. It was they who wanted to live in a country that reflected their own values and beliefs, that inspired them to get on a bus, to travel for 8 hours, to stand in the Washington sun in the middle of August to hear Dr. King speak. Being in Washington that day was simply one of the things that they did to prove what they believed. Showing up was one of the what's to their own why. This was a cause, and it was their cause. Dr. King's speech itself served as a visceral reminder of the belief shared by everyone who stood there listening. And that speech was about what he believed, not how they were going to get there. He gave the I Have a Dream speech, not the I have a plan speech. It was a statement of purpose and not a comprehensive 12-point plan to achieving civil rights in America. Dr. King offered America a place to go, not a plan to follow. The plan had its place, but not on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Dr. King's articulation of his belief was something powerful enough to rally those who shared that belief, even if they weren't personally affected by the inequalities. Nearly a quarter of the people who came to the rally that day were white. This was a belief not about black America. This was a belief about a shared America. Dr. King was the leader of a cause for all those who believed what he believed, regardless of skin color. It wasn't the details of his plan that earned him the right to lead. It was what he believed and his ability to communicate it clearly that people followed. In essence, he, like all great leaders, became the symbol of the belief. Dr. King came to personify the cause. To this day, we build statues of him to keep the belief alive and tangible. People followed him not because of his idea of a changed America. People followed him because of their idea of a changed America. The part of the brain that influences our behaviors and decisions does not have the capacity for language. We have trouble saying clearly, in emotional terms, why we do what we do, and offer rationalizations that, though valid and true, are not powerful enough to inspire others. So when asked why they showed up that day, people pointed to Dr. King and said simply, "Because I believe." More than anything else, what Martin Luther King Jr. gave us was clarity, a way to explain how we felt. He gave us the words that inspired us. He gave us something to believe in, something we could easily share with our friends. Everyone at the mall that day shared a set of values and beliefs, and everyone there that day, regardless of skin color or race or sex, trusted each other. It was that trust, that common bond, that shared belief that fueled a movement that would change a nation. We believed, we believed, we believed. Part 4. How to Rally Those Who Believe. Chapter 8. Start with why, but know how. Energy excites, charisma inspires. With a roar, Steve Ballmer, the man who replaced Bill Gates as CEO of Microsoft, bursts onto the stage of the company's annual Global Summit meeting. Ballmer loves Microsoft. He says so in no uncertain words. He also knows how to pump a crowd. His energy is almost folkloric. He pumps his fists and runs from one end of the stage to the other. He screams and he sweats. He is remarkable to watch, and the crowd loves it. As Ballmer proves, without a doubt, energy can motivate a crowd. But can it inspire a population? What happens the next day or the next week when Ballmer's energy is not there to motivate his employees? Is energy enough to keep a company of 80,000 people focused? In contrast, Bill Gates is shy and awkward, a social misfit. He does not fit the stereotype of the leader of a multi-billion dollar company. He is not the most energetic public speaker. When Bill Gates speaks, however, people listen with bated breath. They hang on his every word. When Gates speaks, he doesn't rally a room. He inspires it. Those who hear him take what he says and carry his words with them for weeks, months, or years. Gates doesn't have energy. But Bill Gates inspires. Energy motivates, but charisma inspires. Energy is easy to see, easy to measure, and easy to copy. Charisma is hard to define, near impossible to measure, and too elusive to copy. All great leaders have charisma because all great leaders have clarity of why, the undying belief in their own purpose or cause that's bigger than themselves. It's not Bill Gates' passion for computers that inspires us. It's his undying optimism that even the most complicated problems can be solved. He believes that we can find ways to remove obstacles to ensure that everyone can live and work to their greatest potential. It is his optimism to which we are drawn. Living through the computer revolution, he saw the computer as a perfect technology to help us all become more productive and achieve our greatest potential. That belief inspired his vision of a PC on every desk to come to life. It's ironic, considering Microsoft never even made PCs. It wasn't just what computers did that Gates saw the impact for the new technology. It was why we needed them, Today, the work he does with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has nothing to do with software, but it is another way he has found to bring his why to life. He is looking for ways to solve problems. He still has an undying belief, and he still believes that if we can help people, this time those with less privilege, remove some of the seemingly simple obstacles, then they too will have an opportunity to be more productive and lift themselves up to achieve their greatest potential. For Gates, all that has changed is what he is doing to bring his cause to life. Charisma has nothing to do with energy. It comes from clarity of why. It comes from an absolute conviction in an ideal bigger than oneself. Energy, in contrast, comes from a good night's sleep or lots of caffeine. Energy can excite, but only charisma can inspire. Charisma commands loyalty. Energy does not. Energy can always be injected into an organization to motivate people to do things. Bonuses, promotions, other carrots, and even a few sticks can get people to work harder for sure. But the gains are, like all manipulations, short-term. Over time, such tactics cost money and increase stress both for employee and employer alike, and eventually will become the main reason people show up for work every day. That's not loyalty. That's the employee version of repeat business. Loyalty among employees is when they turn down more money or more benefits to continue working at the same company. Loyalty to a company trumps pay and benefits. And unless you're an astronaut, it's not the work we do that inspires us either. It's the cause we come to work for. We don't want to come to work to build a wall. We want to come to work to build a cathedral. The Chosen Path. Raised in Ohio, 60 miles from Dayton, Neil Armstrong grew up on a healthy diet of stories about the Wright brothers. From a very early age, he dreamed of flying. He'd make model airplanes and read magazines about flying and stare at the heavens through a telescope mounted on the roof of his house. He even got his pilot's license before he got his driver's license. With a childhood passion that became reality, Armstrong was destined to become an astronaut. For the rest of us, however, our career paths are more like Jeff Sumter's. While Sumter was in high school, his mother arranged for him to get a summer internship at the bank that she worked at. 4 years after he finished high school, he called the bank to see if he could do some part-time work, and eventually they offered him a full-time job. Whammo, Jeff's got a career as a banker. In fact, after 15 years in the industry, he and a colleague named Trey Moust went on to start their own bank, the Lewis and Clark Bank in Portland, Oregon. Sumter is very good at what he does. He's been one of the top-performing loan officers throughout his career. He's well-liked and well-respected among his colleagues and clients. But even Jeff will admit that he doesn't have much of a passion for banking, per se. Though he's not living out his childhood dream, he is passionate for something. It's not what he does that gets him out of bed every morning. It's why he does it. Our career paths are largely incidental. I never planned on doing what I'm doing now. As a kid, I wanted to be an astronaut. But in college, I set my sights on becoming a criminal prosecutor. While I was in law school, however, I became disillusioned with the idea of being a lawyer. It just didn't feel right. I was at law school in England, where the law is one of the last truly English professions. Not wearing a pinstripe suit to an interview could hurt my chances of getting a job, and that's just not my cup of tea. I happened to be dating a young woman who was studying marketing at Syracuse University at the time. She could see what inspired me and what frustrated me about the law and suggested I try my hand in the field. And whammo, I've gotten myself a new career in marketing. But that's just one of the things I've done. It's not my passion, and it's not how I define my life. My cause, to inspire people to do the things that inspire them, is why I get out of bed every day. The excitement is trying to find new ways, different what's, to bring my cause to life, of which this book is just one. Regardless of what we do in our lives, our why, our driving purpose, cause, or belief never changes. If our golden circle is in balance, what we do is simply the tangible way we find to breathe life into that cause. Developing software was merely one of those things that Bill Gates did to bring his cause to life. An airline gave Herb Kelleher the perfect outlet to spread his belief in freedom. Putting a man on the moon was one goal John F. Kennedy used to rally people to bring to life his belief that service to the nation, not being serviced by the nation, would lead America to advance and prosper. Apple gave Steve Jobs a way to challenge the status quo and do something big in the world. All the things these charismatic leaders did were tangible ways they found to bring their whys to life, but none of them could have imagined what they would be doing when they were young. When a why is clear, those who share that belief will be drawn to it and maybe want to take part in bringing it to life. If that belief is amplified, it can have the power to rally even more believers to raise their hands and declare, "I want to help." With a group of believers all rallying around a common purpose, cause, or belief, amazing things can happen. But it takes more than inspiration to become great. Inspiration only starts the process. You need something more to drive a movement. Amplify the source of inspiration. The Golden Circle is not just a communication tool. It also provides some insight into how great organizations are organized. As we start to add dimension to the concept of the Golden Circle, it is no longer helpful to look at it as purely two-dimensional. If it is to provide any real value in how to build a great organization in our very three-dimensional world, the Golden Circle needs to be three-dimensional also. The good news is, it is. It is, in fact, a top-down view of a cone. Turn those three circles sideways onto their side, and you can see what its full value is. The cone represents a company, or an organization, an inherently hierarchical and organized system. Sitting on top of that system, representing the why, is a leader. In the case of a company, that's usually the CEO, or we hope it is. The next level down, the how level, typically includes the senior executives, who are inspired by the leader's vision and know how to bring it to life. Don't forget that a why is just a belief. Hows are the actions we take to realize that belief, and what's are the results of those actions. No matter how charismatic or inspiring the leader is, if there are not people in the organization inspired to bring that vision to reality, to build an infrastructure with systems and processes, then at best, inefficiency reigns, and at worst, failure results. In this rendering, the how level represents a person or a small group responsible for building the infrastructure that can make a why tangible. That may happen in marketing, operations, finance, human resources, and all the other C-suite departments. Beneath that, at the what level, is where the rubber meets the road. It is at this level that the majority of the employees sit and where all tangible stuff actually happens. I have a dream, and he has a plan. Dr. King said he had a dream, and he inspired people to make his dream their own. What Ralph Abernathy lent the movement was something else. He knew what it would take to realize that dream, and he showed people how to do it. He gave the dream structure. Dr. King spoke about the philosophical implications of the movement, while Abernathy, Dr. King's one-time mentor, longtime friend, and financial secretary and treasurer of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, would help people understand the specific steps they needed to take. "Now," Abernathy would tell the audience after a rousing address by Dr. King, "let me tell you what this means for you tomorrow morning." Dr. King was the leader, but he didn't change America alone. Though Dr. King inspired the movement, to actually move people requires organizing. As is the case with almost all great leaders, there were others around Dr. King who knew better how to do it. For every great leader, for every Y type, there is an inspired how type, or group of how types, who take the intangible cause and build the infrastructure that can give it life. That infrastructure is what usually makes any measurable change or success possible. The leader sits at the top of the cone, at the start, the point of why, while the how types sit below and are responsible for actually making things happen. The leader imagines the destination, and the how types find the route to get there. A destination without a route leads to meandering and inefficiency, something a great many Y-types will experience without the help of others to ground them. A route without a destination, however, may be efficient, but to what end? It's all fine and good to know how to drive, but it's more fulfilling when you have a place to go. For Dr. King, Ralph Abernathy was one of those he inspired and who knew how to make the cause actionable and tangible. Dr. King's job was to interpret the ideology and theology of nonviolence, said Abernathy. My job was more simple and down to earth. I would tell people, don't ride those buses. In every case of a great charismatic leader who ever achieved anything of significance, there was always a person or small group lurking in the shadows who knew how to take the vision and make it a reality. Dr. King had a dream. But no matter how inspiring a dream may be, a dream that cannot come to life stays a dream. Dr. King dreamed of many of the same things as countless other African Americans who grew up in the pre-civil rights South. He spoke of many of the same themes. He felt the same outrage perpetuated by an unjust system. But it was Dr. King's unflappable optimism and his words that inspired a population. Dr. King didn't change America by himself. He wasn't a legislator, for example. But legislation was created to give all people in the United States equal rights regardless of skin color. It wasn't Dr. King who changed America. It was the movement of millions of others who he inspired that changed the course of history. But how do you organize millions of people? Forget millions, how do you organize hundreds or tens of people? The vision and charisma of the leader are enough to attract the innovators and the early adopters. Trusting their guts and their intuition, these people will make the greatest sacrifices to see the vision come to reality. With each success, with each tangible demonstration that the vision can in fact become reality, the more practical-minded majority will start to take interest. What was previously just a dream soon becomes a provable and tangible reality. And when that happens, a tipping point can be reached, and then things really get moving. Those who know why need those who know how. The pessimists are usually right, to paraphrase Tom Friedman, but it's the optimists who change the world. Bill Gates imagined a world in which the computer could help us all reach our greatest potential, and it happened. Now he imagines a world in which malaria does not exist, and it will happen. The Wright brothers imagined a world in which we'd all take to the skies as easily as we catch the bus, and it happened. Y-types have the power to change the course of industries or even the world, if only they knew how. Y-types are the visionaries, the ones with the overactive imaginations. They tend to be optimists who believe that all things they can imagine can actually be accomplished. How-types live more in the here and now. They are the realists and have a clearer sense of all things practical. Y-types are focused on the things most people can't see, like the future. How-types are focused on the things most people can see and tend to be better at building structures and processes to get things done. One is not better than the other. They are just different ways people naturally see and experience the world. Gates is a Y-type. So were the Wright brothers and Steve Jobs and Herb Kelleher. But they didn't do it alone. They couldn't. They needed those who know how. If it hadn't been for my big brother, I'd be in jail several times for checks bouncing, said Walt Disney, only half joking, to a Los Angeles audience in 1957. I never knew what was in the bank. He kept me on the straight and narrow. Walt Disney was a Y-type, a dreamer whose dream came true thanks to the help of his more sensible older brother, Roy, a How-type. Walt Disney began his career creating cartoon drawings for advertisements, but moved quickly to making animated movies. It was 1923, and Hollywood is emerging as the heart of the movie business, and Walt wanted to be a part of it. Roy, who was 8 years older, had been working at a bank. Roy was always in awe of his brother's talent and imagination, but he also knew that Walt was prone to taking risks and to neglecting business affairs. Like all Y guys, Walt was busy thinking about what the future looked like and often forgot that he was living in the present. Walt Disney dreamed, drew, and imagined. Roy stayed in the shadows, forming an empire, wrote Bob Thomas, a Disney biographer. A brilliant financier and businessman, Roy helped turn Walt Disney's dream into reality, building the company that bears his brother's name. It was Roy who founded the Buena Vista Distribution Company and made Disney films a central part of the American childhood. It was Roy who created the merchandising business that transformed Disney characters into household names. And, like most every How-type, Roy never wanted to be the front man. He preferred to stay in the background and focus on how to build his brother's vision. Most people in the world are how-types. Most people are quite functional in the real world and can do their jobs and do very well. Some may be very successful and even make millions of dollars, but they will never build billion-dollar companies or change the world. How-types don't need Y-types to do well, but Y-guys, for all their vision and imagination, often get the short end of the stick. Without someone inspired by their vision and the knowledge to make it happen, most Y-types end up as starving visionaries, people with all the answers but never accomplishing much themselves. Although so many of them fancy themselves visionaries, in reality, most successful entrepreneurs are How-types. Ask an entrepreneur what they love about being an entrepreneur, and they will tell you that they love to build things. That they talk about building is a sure clue that they know how to get things done. A business is a structure, systems and processes that need to be assembled. It is the how types who are more adept at building those processes and systems. But most companies, no matter how well built, do not become billion-dollar businesses or change the course of industries. To reach billion-dollar status, to alter the course of an industry, requires a very special and rare partnership between one who knows why and those who know how. In nearly every case of a person or an organization that has gone on to inspire people and do great things, there exists this special partnership between why and how. Bill Gates, for example, may have been the visionary who imagined a world with a PC on every desk, but Paul Allen built the company. Herb Kelleher was able to personify and preach the cause of freedom, but it was Rollin King who came up with the idea for Southwest Airlines. Steve Jobs is the rebel's evangelist, but Steve Wozniak is the engineer who made the Apple work. Jobs had the vision, Woz had the goods. It is this partnership of a vision of the future and the talent to get it done that makes an organization great. It is this relationship that starts to clarify the difference between a vision statement and a mission statement in an organization. The vision is the public statement of the founder's intent, why the company exists. It is literally the vision of a future that does not yet exist. The mission statement is a description of the route, the guiding principles, how the company intends to create that future. When both of those things are stated clearly, the why type and the how type are both certain about their roles in this partnership. Both are working together with clarity of purpose and the plan to get there. For it to work, however, it requires more than a set of skills. It requires trust. As discussed at length in Part 3, trusting relationships are invaluable for us to feel safe. Our ability to trust people or organizations allows us to take risks and feel supported in our efforts. And perhaps the most trusting relationship that exists is between the visionary and the builder, the why guy and the how guy. In organizations able to inspire, the best chief executives are why types, people who wake up every day to lead a cause and not just run a company. In these organizations, the best chief financial officers or chief operating officers are high-performing how types, those with the strength of ego to admit that they are not visionaries themselves, but are inspired by the leader's vision and know how to build it and build the structure that can bring it to life. The best how types generally do not want to be out front, preaching the vision. They prefer to work behind the scenes to build the systems that can make the vision a reality. It takes the combined skill and effort of both for great things to happen. It's not an accident that these unions of why and how so often come from families or old friendships. A shared upbringing and life experience increases the probability of a shared set of values and beliefs. In the case of family or childhood friends, upbringing and common experiences are nearly exactly the same. It's not to say you can't find a good partner somewhere else. It's just that growing up with somebody and having a common life experience increases the likelihood of a shared common worldview. Walt Disney and Roy Disney were brothers. Bill Gates and Paul Allen went to high school together in Seattle. Herb Kelleher was Rollin King's divorce attorney and old friend. Martin Luther King Jr. and Ralph Abernathy both preached in Birmingham long before the civil rights movement took form. And Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak were best friends in high school. The list goes on. To run or to lead. For all those talented how types running today's organizations, they can achieve success that will last their lifetimes, but they will spend their lifetimes running their companies. There are many ways to be successful and drive profits. Any number of manipulations, only some of which I've touched upon in this book, work quite well. Even the ability to create a tipping point is possible without creating lasting change. It's called a fad. But great organizations function exactly like a social movement. They inspire people to talk about a product or idea, include that product in the context of their lifestyle, share the idea, or even find ways to advance the prosperity of the organization itself. Great organizations not only excite the human spirit, they inspire people to take part in helping to advance the cause without needing to pay them or incentivize them in any particular way. No cashback incentives or mail-in rebates required. People feel compelled to spread the word, not because they have to, but because they want to. They willingly take up arms to share the message that inspires them. build a megaphone that works. After a three-month selection process, BCI finally chose a new ad agency to help develop a campaign to launch their new product line. Big Company Incorporated is a well-known brand operating in a fairly cluttered market space. As a manufacturer, their products are sold via a third-party sales force, often on the shelves of big-box retailers, so they don't have direct control over the sales process. The best they can do is try to influence the sale from a distance with marketing. BCI is a good company with a strong culture. The employees respect the management, and in general, the company does good work. But over the years, the competition has grown fairly stiff. And although BCI has a good product and competitive pricing, it is still tough to maintain strong growth year over year. This year, BCI management is particularly excited because the company is launching a new product they really think will make BCI stand out. To help promote it, BCI's agency has launched a major new ad campaign. "From the leading maker," says the new ad, "comes the newest, most innovative product you've ever seen." The ad goes on to talk about all the new features and benefits and includes something about the quality you've come to expect from BCI, something the BCI executives felt quite strongly about including. The BCI executives have worked hard to build their company's reputation, and they want to leverage it. They are very excited about their new campaign and are really banking on the success of this product to help drive sales in general. They know they do good work, and they want to get the message out. They need to be loud. And with a budget of millions of dollars to advertise their new product, in that respect, BCI succeeds. But there's a problem. BCI and their agency did a good job of telling people about their new product. The work was quite creative. They were all able to explain what was new and special about the latest innovation, and focus groups agreed that the new product was much better than that of the competition. The millions of dollars in media ensured that lots of people would see their advertising and see it often. The reach and frequency, the measurement commonly used by ad agencies to gauge the number of people exposed to the advertising, was good. There is no doubt that their message was loud. The problem was, it wasn't clear. It was all what's and how, and no why. Even though people learned what the product did, no one knew what BCI believed. The good news is, it's not a complete loss. The products will sell as long as the ads are on the air and the promotions remain competitive. It's an effective strategy, but an expensive way to make money. What if Martin Luther King had delivered a comprehensive 12-point plan about achieving civil rights in America, a plan more comprehensive than any other plan for civil rights ever before? Booming through the speakers that day in 1963, his message would have been loud. Microphones, like advertising and PR, are fantastic for making sure a message is heard. Like BCI, King's message would still have reached thousands of people, but his belief would not have been clear. Volume is reasonably easy to achieve. All it takes is money or stunts. Money can pay to keep a message front and center, and publicity stunts are good at getting on the news, but neither plant seeds of loyalty. Many listening to this may remember that Oprah Winfrey once gave away a free car to every member of her studio audience. It happened several years ago, in 2004, and people still refer to the stunt. But how many people can recall the model of car she gave away? And that's the problem. It was Pontiac that donated $7 million worth of cars, 276 of their new G6 model, to be exact. And it was Pontiac that saw the stunt as a way to market their new car. Yet although the stunt worked well to reinforce Oprah's generous nature, something with which we were all familiar, few people remember that Pontiac was part of the event. Worse, the stunt didn't do anything to reinforce some purpose, cause, or belief that Pontiac represents. We had no idea what Pontiac's why was before the stunt, so it's hard for the publicity stunt to do much more than, well, be a stunt to get some publicity. With no sense of why, there's nothing else it's doing. For a message to have real impact, to affect behavior and seed loyalty, it needs more than publicity. It needs to publicize some higher purpose, cause, or belief to which those with similar values and beliefs can relate. Only then can the message create some lasting mass market success. For a stunt to appeal to the left side of the curve of the law of diffusion, why the stunt is being performed beyond the desire to generate press must be clear. Though there may be short-term benefits without clarity, loud is nothing more than excess volume, or, in business vernacular, clutter. And companies wonder why differentiation is such a challenge these days. Have you heard the volume coming out of some of them? In contrast, what would have been the impact of Dr. King's speech had he not had a microphone and loudspeakers? His vision would have been no less clear. His words would have been no less inspiring. He knew what he believed, and he spoke with passion and charisma about that belief. But only the few people with front row seats would have been inspired by those words. A leader with a cause, whether it be an individual or an organization, must have a megaphone through which to deliver his message. And it must be clear and loud to work. Clarity of purpose, cause, or belief is important. But it is equally important that people hear you. For a why to have the power to move people, it must not only be clear, it must be amplified to reach enough people to tip the scale. It's no coincidence that the three-dimensional version of the golden circle is a cone. It is, in practice, a megaphone. An organization effectively becomes the vessel through which a person with a clear purpose, cause, or belief can speak to the outside world. But for a megaphone to work, clarity must come first. Without a clear message, what will you amplify? Say it only if you believe it. Dr. King used his megaphone to rally throngs of people to follow him in pursuit of social justice. The Wright brothers used their megaphone to rally their local community to help build the technology that could change the world. Thousands of people heard John F. Kennedy's belief in service and rallied to put a man on the moon in less than a decade. The ability to excite and inspire people, to go out of their way, to contribute to something bigger than themselves, is not unique to social causes. Any organization is capable of building a megaphone that can achieve a huge impact. In fact, it is one of the defining factors that makes an organization great. Great organizations don't just drive profits, they lead people, and they change the course of industries and sometimes our lives in the process. A clear sense of why sets expectations. When we don't know an organization's why, we don't know what to expect. So we expect the minimum: price, quality, service, features, the commodity stuff. But when we do have a sense for the why, we expect more. For those not comfortable being held to a higher standard, I strongly advise against trying to learn your why or keeping your golden circle in balance. Higher standards are hard to maintain. It requires the discipline to constantly talk about and remind everyone why the organization exists in the first place. It requires that everyone in the organization be held accountable to how you do things, to your values and guiding principles. And it takes time and effort to ensure that everything you say and everything you do is consistent with your why. But for those willing to put in the effort, there are some great advantages. Richard Branson first built Virgin Records into a multi-billion dollar retail music brand. Then he started a successful record label. Later, he started an airline that is today considered one of the premier airlines in the world. He then launched a soda brand, wedding planning company, insurance company, and mobile phone service, and the list goes on. Likewise, Apple sells us computers, mobile phones, DVRs, and MP3 players, and has replicated their capacity for innovation again and again. The ability for some companies not to just succeed, but to repeat their success, is due to the loyal following they command and the throngs of people who root for their success. In the business world, they say Apple is a lifestyle brand. They underestimate Apple's power. Gucci is a lifestyle brand. Apple changes the course of industries. By any definition, these few companies don't function like corporate entities. They exist as social movements. Repeating greatness. Ron Bruder is not a household name, but he is a great leader. In 1985, he stood at a crosswalk with his two daughters, waiting for the light to change so they could cross the street. A perfect opportunity, he thought, to teach the young girls a valuable life lesson. He pointed across the street to the red glow of the Do Not Walk sign and asked them what they thought the sign meant. "It means we have to stand here," they replied. "Are you sure?" he asked rhetorically. "How do you know it's not telling us to run?" Soft-spoken, and almost always wearing a well-tailored three-piece suit when he comes to work, Ron Bruder looks like what you would imagine a conservative executive to look like. But don't assume you know how things work simply based on what you see. Ron Bruder is anything but a stereotype. Though he has enjoyed the trappings of success, he is not motivated by them. They have always been the unintended byproduct of his work. Bruder is driven by a clear sense of why. He sees a world in which people accept the lives they live and do the things they do because they have to, because no one ever showed them an alternative. This is the lesson he was teaching his daughters that day at the crosswalk. There is always another perspective to be considered. That brooder always starts with why has enabled him to achieve great things for himself. But more significantly, it is his ability to share his why through the things he does that inspires those around him to do great things for themselves. Like most of us, the career path Ron Bruder has followed is incidental. But why he does things has never changed. Everything Bruder has ever done starts with his why, his unyielding belief that if you can simply show someone that an alternative route is possible, it can open up the possibility that such a route can actually be followed. Though the work he is doing today is world-altering, Bruder hasn't always been in the world peace business. Like many inspiring leaders, he has changed the course of an industry. But Ron Bruder is no one-hit wonder. He has been able to repeat his success and change the course of multiple industries multiple times. A senior executive at a large food conglomerate that sold vegetables, canned goods, and meats decided to buy a travel agency for his nephew. He asked Bruder, as the chief financial officer of the company at the time, to look at the financials of the agency before he went through with the purchase. Seeing an opportunity others didn't, Bruder decided to join the small travel agency to help lead it. Once there, he saw how all the other travel agencies worked and took an alternative course. Greenwell became the first travel agency on the Eastern Seaboard to take advantage of new technologies and fully computerize their operations. Not only did they become one of the most successful companies in the region, but after only a year, their business model became the standard for the whole industry. Then Bruder did it again. A former client of Bruder's, Sam Rosengarten, was in some dirty businesses: coal, oil, and gas. All industries that created brownfields, land that had been contaminated by their operations. Little could be done with these brownfields. They were too polluted to develop, and the liability to clean them up was so high that the insurance premiums alone made it too prohibitive to even try. But Bruder doesn't see challenges the same way as everyone else. Most avoided brownfields because they could see only the cost to clean them up. Bruder focused instead on the actual cleaning. His alternative perspective revealed the perfect solution. Bruder had already formed a real estate development company, Brookhill, and with 18 employees, he was doing quite well. Knowing what he needed to do to seize the opportunity, he approached Dames & Moore, one of the largest environmental engineering companies in the world, and shared his new perspective with them. They loved his idea and formed a partnership to pursue it. With an engineering company with 18,000 people on board, the perceived risk was greatly minimized, and the insurance companies were happy to offer affordable insurance. With affordable insurance in place, Credit Suisse First Boston offered financing that gave Brookhill the ability to buy, remediate, redevelop, and sell almost $200 million worth of former environmentally contaminated properties. Brookhill, so-called because Bruder comes from Brooklyn and, as he puts it, it's a long uphill climb to get out of Brooklyn, was the pioneer of the brownfield redevelopment industry, an industry that thrives to this day. Bruder's why not only steered a path that was good for business, but in the process also helped clean up the environment. It doesn't matter what Ron Bruder does. The industries and challenges are incidental. What never changes is why he does things. Bruder knows that no matter how good an opportunity looks on paper, no matter how smart he is, and no matter his track record, he would never be able to achieve anything unless there are others there to help him. He knows that success is a team sport. He has a remarkable ability to attract those who believe what he believes. Talented people are drawn to him with one request: how can I help? Having defied accepted perspectives and revolutionized more than one industry, Bruder has now set his sights on a bigger challenge: world peace. He founded the Education for Employment Foundation, the megaphone that would help him do it. The EFE Foundation is making significant headway in helping young men and women in the Middle East to significantly alter the course of their lives, and indeed, the course of the region, just as he taught his daughters at the crosswalk that there is always an alternative route. He brings an alternative perspective to the problems in the Middle East. Like all Bruder's past successes, the EFE Foundation will drive businesses and do tremendous amounts of good in the process. Bruder doesn't run companies. He leads movements. all movements are personal. It started on September 11, 2001. Like so many of us, Ron Bruder turned his attention to the Middle East after the attacks to ask why something like that could happen. He understood that if such an event could happen once, it could happen again, and for the lives of his own daughters, he wanted to find a way to prevent that. In the course of trying to figure out what he could do, he made a remarkable discovery that went much deeper than protecting his daughters or even the prevention of terrorism in the United States. In America, he realized, the vast majority of young people wake up in the morning with a feeling that there is opportunity for them in the future. Regardless of the economy, most young boys and girls who grow up in the United States have an inherent sense of optimism that they can achieve something if they want to live the American dream. A young boy growing up in Gaza or a young girl living in Yemen does not wake up every day with the same feeling. Even if they have the desire, the same optimism is not there. It is too easy to point and say that the culture is different. That is not actionable. The real reason is that there is a distinct lack of institutions to give young people in the region a sense of optimism for their own futures. A college education in Jordan, for example, may offer some social status, but it doesn't necessarily prepare a young adult for what lies ahead. The education system, in cases like this, perpetuates a systemic cultural pessimism. Bruder realized the problems we face with terrorism in the West have less to do with what young boys and girls in the Middle East think about America and more to do with what they think about themselves and their own vision of the future. Through the EFE Foundation, Bruder is setting up programs across the Middle East to teach young adults the hard and soft skills that will help them feel like they have opportunity in life, to feel like they can be in control of their own destinies. Bruder is using the EFE Foundation to share his why on a global scale, to teach people that there is always an alternative to the path they think they are on. The Education for Employment Foundation is not an American charity hoping to do good in faraway lands. It is a global movement. Each EFE operation runs independently, with locals making up the majority of their local boards. Local leaders take personal responsibility to give the young men and women that feeling of opportunity by giving them the skills, knowledge, and most importantly, the confidence to choose an alternative path for themselves. Mayada Abu Jabir is leading the movement in Jordan. Mohammed Najah is spreading the cause in Gaza and the West Bank. And Mayin Al-Riyani is proving that a cause can even change a culture in Yemen. In Yemen, children can expect to receive 9 years of education. This is one of the lowest rates in the world. In the United States, children can expect 16 years. Inspired by Bruder, Al-Riyani sees such an amazing opportunity for young men and women to change their perspective and take greater control of their future. He set out to find capital to jumpstart his EFE operation in Sana'a, Yemen's capital, and in 1 week was able to raise $50,000. The speed at which he raised that amount is pretty good, even by our philanthropic standards. But this is Yemen, and Yemen has no culture of philanthropy, making his achievement that much more remarkable. Yemen is also one of the poorest nations in the region. But when you tell people why you're doing what you're doing, remarkable things happen. Across the region, everyone involved in EFE believes that they can help teach their brothers and sisters and sons and daughters the skills that will help them change the path that they think they're on. They are working to help the youth across the region believe that their future is bright and full of opportunity. And they don't do it for Bruder. They do it for themselves. That's the reason EFE will change the world. Sitting at the top of the megaphone, at the point of why, Bruder's role is to inspire, to start the movement. But it is those who believe who will effect the real change and keep the movement going. Anyone, regardless where they live, what they do, or their nationality, can participate in this movement. It's about feeling like we belong. If you believe that there is an alternative path to the one we're on, and that all we have to do is point to it and make it available to others, then visit the website efefoundation.org and join the movement. To change the world takes the support of all of those who believe.